Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
The Men About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, let's start with some announcements. I have some, but they're on my phone and it just crashed. So, Saturday at the Staten Island Yankees is the first ever Unforgettable IPA and Taco Festival.
Exactly why I didn't forget it, even though your phone died.
I know. I don't have the time memorized, but I think it's from approximately 1 to 5 p.m. And
benefits New York City Brewers Guild.
As well as another good cause, which I can't remember.
Locked in your phone?
Oh, yeah, man. I got to get a new phone or something. Anyway, these, right. Yes. Anyway, tickets are available online if you Google Unforgettable IPA and Taco Festivals, Staten Island. They will come up. It looks like it'll be a great time.
Big shout out to Flagship for helping organize that. They really took a lead in doing it, and it's awesome. And we don't get out to Staten Island often enough, but we should.
It looks like it's 1 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, June 10th, and it is benefiting the New York City Brewers Guild as well as No Kid Hungry.
No Kid Hungry, that's awesome. Right.
I will say that because we haven't had a live show since Memorial Day, right?
That's true.
No. Mm-hmm. So I did actually the Friday of Memorial Day weekend, my friend Heather and I took the lovely Staten Island Ferry down to Staten Island. We had a slice at that great slice place. Pier 76, I believe.
Pier 76, that's correct. Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Exactly.
And
we're not running full steam today. We're all sick in the studio today.
Between Kuzmi and I, we have one full break somewhere. And anyway, and then we got to hang out at Flagship Brewery. Pat Morse, the head brewer, hung out with us, and it was super good. I haven't been down there in a while, and it is such a lovely brewery. That is such a lovely trip down. You get to see Ellis Island, Statue of Liberty, downtown Manhattan. It's just, anyway, I love ferries, but I really love the Staten Island
ferry. People sleep on that free ferry.
That's ridiculous. I mean, you can also drink beer on the ferry.
Yes.
So that's what you do. You go, next time you visit New York City, go get your beer at little beer stand in the Staten Island Ferry Terminal. They have some local beers. I had a Bronx Pale Ale. They have some Flagship beers as well. They'll give you a brown bag. You get on the ferry. You don't require a brown bag because it's totally legal. Get on the ferry, crack open your beer, enjoy these delightful views, and then you can walk down to a Flagship Brewery, get a slice on the way, and there's also great Sri Lankan food. Anyway, one of my favorite day trip or, evening trips to do.
So it's June 10th, huh?
Yeah, June 10th.
All right.
Staten Island Ferry. Staten Island Ferry is free. It's
what else is happening that weekend?
Yeah. Oh, what else is happening that weekend?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff happening. So once you do that on Saturday, you'll be wanting to stay awake on Sunday. So you should head over to the Iced Coffee and Tea Festival, related to the Coffee and Tea Festival that I went to back in, I believe it was May. Except it's for ice stuff because it's now hot out. So it's June 11th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Brooklyn Expo Center. For tickets, you can check out the coffeeandteafestival.com, and it'll have all the links for the New York one. And I went to the hot one, and it was so much fun. It's overwhelming, but it's so great. But remember to pace yourself when it comes to caffeine and know what you can handle.
But if you have all that up stuff in the morning, you know, how that's pretty close to Long Island City. What's happening
exactly.
in Long Island City?
Exactly. That's what I'm going to do Sunday. I'm going to walk up to Greenpoint, to the Brooklyn Expo Center for the Iced Coffee and Tea Festival. And then after that, because it looks like it's going to be nice weather, I'm going to walk up to Big Alice.
What's going on there, Chris?
Oh, it's their fourth anniversary party. They are turning four this year. They're from noon to 8 p.m. They will be celebrating in the backyard with a lot of barbecue and a lot of different special beers that they've busted out for it, including collaborations and the like. And also, they're going to have quite the music scene happening. They're setting up a PA system, and none other than your own Chris Cousby is going to play with the home musicians, and I'm very excited about that. At 5 o'clock, we're going to say, hey, thank you very much. I'll be here all week, or at least one day at Big Alice, and that's Sunday the 11th at 5 p.m. Other things happening very soon. I'm very excited about this event that we're going to throw at Fifth Hammer Brewing Company in August. Stan Hieronymus is coming out with his new book on foraging and incorporating that into beers. And on some of our very early episodes, we talked about foraging and an event that we're inspired by Eric Steen called Beers Made by Walking. Where he gets brewers to go out on a walk and make beers based on what they see or forage on their walk. So Steve Brill does these tours in the local parks of New York City. I've been wanting to link up with him for a long time. Anyway, on July 9th, we're going to link up with him, and we're going to go on a tour of Prospect Park and look at all of the edible plants and what our local flora is, and things that we can incorporate into brewing or other ferments. And it's not just for home brewers. If you'd like to go to it and just want to know more about what's going on in our city that is forageable, you can do that. Go to bitterandesters.com, and there is an event page for it for local foraging with Steve Brill. And so we hope to go on July 9th, Sunday, July 9th at 5 p.m., and then hopefully some of us will homebrew some stuff to share with Stan Hieronymus when we host him on August 19th at Fifth Hammer. And that's what I have to say about that. Oh, but also happening in August, I get to announce it early because...
Yeah, do it.
Because it takes a while to make mead, even with staggered nutrient additions. Mead Day is August 5th. Things are going to be happening. Not sure what yet, but August 5th is Mead Day.
Oh, better put up your mead right now.
Put up your mead. That's what I got to say about that.
And then looking forward to the end of the month, the New Mexican Fermentation Festival is going to be Saturday, June 24th between 11 a.m. and 5:30 at the... Oh, I'm going to butcher that name. It's in Albuquerque. Anyway, looks awesome. So if you're looking for a fermentation festival to visit in June, that's the one.
All right.
Better get your tempeh up and running.
Well, speaking of out of town, you were out of town recently, Rachel.
Yeah. Yes. So over the weekend, the long weekend, I went down to Baltimore. Lovely, lovely harbor city. It has a very interesting brew scene there and an interesting fermentation scene as well. And, so while I was down there, I was privileged to be able to talk to the lovely folks at Hex Ferments and in Belvedere Square, which is a beautiful, like, open indoor marketplace. And so that's what we have for you guys today is I recorded an interview with them. So the voices you're going to be hearing are me and the Hex Ferments folks, which is Megan and Shane Carpenter. And you'll later hear a deeper male voice, and that is a Saul Glass Siegel, who is acting as my roadie and photographer.
Right on.
So, guys, enjoy this.
Without further ado, Hex Ferments with Ray Jacobs. A ferment about it.
So, I'm here at Belvedere Market with the owners and creators of Hex Ferments. All right, so do you want to introduce yourself? After you finish eating the avocado with your sauerkraut on top?
Yeah, my name is Megan. My husband and I run Hex Ferments with a team of many wonderful employees and staff. And we're at Belvedere Square Market at our flagship location, where we, up until a year ago, did 100% of our fermentation.
Wow. So since then, you've expanded?
Yes. We quickly grew out of this space and have since expanded to a new production space about three blocks down the road.
Great. So let's just back up a little bit. So how did you guys start fermentation just in general, and how did you decide to start a company based around fermentation?
Too many vegetables.
Too many vegetables. Well, for us, it started much more earlier. We both grew up in the upper Midwest, where we had families that farmed or grew food, canned and preserved, made sour pickles, made sauerkraut. We both have journeyed all over the world, learning new different food techniques. We're really interested in growing food organically or biodynamically. So food preservation has just been a sort of a fabric of our upbringing and our life. How we made, I guess, the big leap into deciding to have a business was we found that our growth in the garden and in the kitchen just kept growing with more and more ferments that we were making. We had moved into a house where we had a little bit more space. A better stove, so we were canning more things. We had places where we could cellar things.
Urban homesteading of sorts.
Yeah, I know, the urban homesteading thing. and we just started kind of seeking out other people that were fermenting. I started making very basic sauerkrauts and kimchis when I worked at a food co-op in Minneapolis about 18 years ago. That was where I was first introduced to the Standard Cat zine. We kind of worked off that. And Shane tangentially was traveling through Wales and through a program called Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And he was learning a lot of, different types of meads and ciders. Also, though, learning a lot about different ways of preservation besides just lacto fermentation. So when we got together, we bonded over a jar of kimchi that was sitting in his refrigerator.
Homemade kimchi?
No, actually, a commercial brand of kimchi. But yeah, in our home, we really kind of grew our home food preservation practice. So we were not just making sauerkrauts, we were making different types of pickles, we were making canned pickles, canned jams, preserves, different meads, different ciders, and went down to Tennessee and hung out with Sander for that weekend.
Oh, you went to his fermentation camp weekend?
We've been to a few. and yeah, just really got really bit by the bug. We were already bit by the bug, but we were now, really, I guess, humming off of it. And then Shane's background is mostly in photography, and my background is mostly in art making. So we both actually have interdisciplinary art degrees. Yours is from University of Washington?
Yep. After a very circuitous path from environmental science to wildlife management to, all kinds of goodies along the way. But, yeah, finally graduated with an interdisciplinary arts degree.
Which is a self-made
really
degree.
Mean?
You can sell, dairy at 7-Eleven, basically. Maybe beer, but that's a different specialty.
It's a journey. It's an educated journey because it took 8 years.
Yeah.
Different schools and different programs and studying bears and touring with bands and
moved around a lot.
Is he studying bears?
I studied grizzly bears and Glacier in Waterton National Park in Canada. I was the scat man. So I would pick up bear poop and then bring it back to dehydrate it for researchers. And then bear rub trees as well. They have this fascinating habit of using the same tree multi-generational between bears to scratch
their back. Yeah. Have you ever seen it? It's like a dance. It's really beautiful.
And they leave their hair in the bark of the tree, so we would collect that with the coordinates. And
all right, so scat man's kind of preservation.
Preserving scat and hair, among other things. But we did, it reminds me.
It goes through microbial gut transformation.
Sure. I mean, it's everywhere.
It's got some gut flora in there.
Sure. Yeah. When we first met, we joked that our common attraction was jars themselves.
Yeah.
Because we both had collected so many different things in jars from, you know, fingernails that Megan would find on
fake,
you know, like fake fingernails. I had a collection of misprint food, you know, like if like a Ritz cracker is coming off and like half of it is stamped with, you know, that type of thing, yeah. Or you know, conjoined fortune
the food
cookies.
Like you're in a bag of Doritos and you reach out and you get the mega Dorito.
It's like a triple stack with, you know, like black seasoning on it. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
So and increasingly rarely do you find those.
And my art practice, so I have a degree from Mount Royal School of Art at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, which is an interdisciplinary program based around whether if you're a photographer, filmmaker, painter, sculptor, drawer, you study in this MFA program where you learn to use all those disciplines or you focus on one discipline. So my whole practice became around the art of preservation, but more in a conceptual framework sense, with mythological and mythos-based theme. And so the last sort of mythos that I created was a myth based around hexology, which is a, just to kind of briefly explain it, stems from Germany in medieval times. It was called the Boucherie or Boucherot, I think, something that I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, but we'll stick with hexology. And it was the practice of using some kind of far out maybe witchcraft practices mixed in with some Christian healing practices. So you would go to a hexologist or a hexen, and you would get cured of any ailment. Whether that be your mother-in-law is driving you up the wall and you just can't seem to shake her, the hex may say you're supposed to take 2 drops of this under a full moon while you bury a piece of her hair, that kind of stuff. So I was really interested in this very medieval form of healing. And so when our practice of fermentation was really getting underway, I was creating this character who would carry remedies on her back and go from town to town and cure people. And those remedies happened to be fermented. So at that point, we kind of joked, what would it be like if we just transferred our fermentation practice into your art practice and called it Hex Ferments? And our friends really kind of were into it, and we kind of got into it. And so then came the journey of trying to become licensed to do it.
And one of our first art, well, in this way, artistic collaborations was me photographing Megan's, what we call the creature. And we had a creature feature of me photographing her in the woods in
costume,
character,
yeah.
As part performance art, but we have photos of it as well, you know, preserved in the lineage of photography that for me is, you know, much about, and for many other people about preservation as well. So all kinds of fascinating intersections, which certainly happen all over, but it's just...
Yeah, we didn't do anything to set out to start a fermentation company. It just kind of happened. And
so
here we are.
So when you guys were starting Hex Ferments, what was the first fermentation you decided to make and sell?
My grandmother's. So we do a classic Eastern European German-style sauerkraut with juniper and caraway, garlic oregano, and our miso kimchi. Those were our top first ferments that we decided to make.
Yeah, the miso kimchi just won a good food award this year, right?
It did, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That.
Yeah, that was sort of came out of left field. We were not expecting that. I'm very flattered.
Well, it's certainly really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the miso kimchi.
Sure.
So instead of traditional kimchi is made with fish sauce.
Yep.
To kind of add that umami flavor, but yours is made with the miso.
Yeah, with a chickpea.
Different kind of fermentation. Yeah, did you make the chickpea miso?
When we were first starting, we made... We were exploring different types of misos, and so we had an adzuki bean miso, different varieties of grains, and we just actually couldn't keep up. So when we opened this space just over 3 years ago, we had five things on our list. We had three krauts, one of which was actually called New Year's Resolution, which we don't do anymore, and then two kombuchas. That's it. And we opened a store, and suddenly we were selling more stuff than we could keep up with, which is a good thing to have when you specialize. And we just couldn't keep up with miso production. So we decided to explore other miso companies that would supply organic, non-GMO.
That reminds me,
we still have some miso here,
when, like, we decided to jump ship. And yeah, gosh, when is that from?
Like 4 years ago?
No, not 3 years ago.
4 years ago? It's 4 years old.
Well,
yeah.
We opened 3 years ago. It can't be 4 years ago.
We started a year before we opened.
Oh, and then just...
That particular one.
Oh, gotcha. All right.
But,
That'll be yummy.
Shane was really dedicated to developing a kimchi recipe that wasn't soupy or runny, that was really thick and full of flavor. So miso kimchi's this guy.
Oh, shucks. No, it's you.
And at the time, we were kind of exploring some food allergen issues of our own, and soy is a big allergen for a lot of people. And so we're like, okay, if we're gonna spend all this time and energy into developing a kimchi when we're not Korean and we're honoring this dish, we're gonna do it right. And so Shane really delved into all the different brining techniques of making kimchi, making different pastes, making different balances with garlic and onion. And when we found out that there was a chickpea miso, we were like, perfect. It's a lighter miso. It's a sweeter miso. It's soy-free. And it added that nice, just subtle umami without competing with the umami that the fermentation is already going to create. So we went through many iterations. We still are refining our kimchi. It's definitely a labor of love at our production space. You know, everybody knows when kimchi weeks are coming up because we're starting to just, like, you know, it takes all week.
Yeah.
You know, you're processing 1,500 pounds of vegetables. You're hand cleaning everything. You're dry brining everything. You're hand pressing everything. You're hand mixing everything. You're draining. I mean, it's a process.
While much of the processes are scalable, it's for us, it's to an extent where you kind of lose the interaction with the vegetable. So we're at a point where, yeah, we work with literally tons of vegetables, but we're still maybe doing it in a pretty old school kind of way. We're not hand chopping. We have the benefit of...
we used to hand chop.
Yeah. We have the benefit of our RoboCoup, or RoboCop, as we call it.
RoboCop?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've seen glimpses into some other more industrial style processors, and it's yeah, both fascinating and, you know, arm's length for us, at least at this point.
Yeah, I'm always interested in the difference between, like, commercial large scale production and, like, making your kimchi or, like, your sauerkraut at home. But let's talk a bit about your kombucha. Actually, you guys have some amazing looking kombuchas.
Megan's getting a whole veggie cross section rolling for you.
Oh my goodness.
They're all kissing cousins.
So what's this crazy, like, purple kombucha that you have? It's butterfly lime.
Yeah. So we make a kombucha. Well, we make many kombuchas, but we make one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listeners, there are like 10 giant barrels of kombucha with all sorts of SCOBYs in them in here.
Yeah.
All different colors, like a beautiful rainbow kombuchas.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we're actually making space for about 3 or 4 more, too. But this is just a fraction.
Are these our secondary fermentation vessels or primary?
Primary. We ferment in this size at our other space.
Oh, my God.
So we do...
I think I can fit in that for scale.
We could ferment Rachel in here, actually.
Am I covered in lactobacillus? Will it work?
Where did she go? She's been gone for months. Yeah, so we... these are all of our micro batches. This is still very small. Even when you compare it to, you know, people that are brewing.
I suppose compared to, like, Hellvade, but, like...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're definitely not... So, yeah, so we have... These are all our small batches. We do seasonals. So we usually just kind of, like, make whatever we wanted with whatever we could get, but then we decided to sort of specialize.
Whatever we could get, but, you know,
locally.
That we're excited about.
Yeah, and excited about. And so now we work with a select few farmers in the area, and they grow things just for a lot of these small batches. So we have one with elderflower and chamomile, jasmine green tea. We have another one that's a yerba mate-based kombucha with local pea flowers and sage. We have another one that's using genmaicha tea, which is a roasted brown rice tea. With a little bit of lemon. We save everything. So a lot of what we use is been preserved in a different way, either through a drying technique, either dehydrated or air drying and then powdered, or from a previous fermentation that we've dried. So everything that goes back in, we have very little waste here. So whatever is used here was dried from somewhere else, and then the substrate will get dried and used for something else. So we right now we have our seasonals. We're just getting those rolling, so unfortunately we don't have any of those in the case right now. But this summer, so we've been training a lot of people this year, and people that work in the shop that also work in production, they got to come up with their flavors. So a lot of this is staff flavors.
Oh, nice.
Working with me to help them find and achieve a flavor balance. That's really important to us, is that you can experience the flavors in whether it's a kimchi or sauerkraut or kombucha. We just don't want it to be one note. So I really have to teach our staff, like, about flavor and about layering flavor, so that when you do drink the kombucha, you're tasting that whole bouquet and not just, oh, it tastes like apple cider vinegar with a little fizz. Yeah. So we do about four micro batch, and then we rotate about six larger batch.
About how long do you ferment the kombucha for?
Depends on the kombucha. So in here, we're usually on a 12 to 14 day cycle.
Okay.
Over at our other production space, we're typically on a 10 day cycle.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Things go a little faster here. It's not as environmentally controlled. Our other space is. So, you know, we're dealing with...
So it's a little cooler in here.
A little cooler, or it can be very hot.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It can get real hot back here.
Oh, yeah, when you're cooking things.
Or just when the whole market's filled and it's warm outside and people are coming in and out, or if the AC breaks down or the power goes out. This market, you know, it's an older market, so we're dealing constantly with the environment itself, too.
Yeah. Can you tell me what this is over here? Like, it looks like capers?
Those are Shisandra berries. So that's one of our more popular small batch. It's called Jasmine Shisandra.
Okay.
It's,
how do you spell that?
S-C-H, this is like one of my worst fears, spell the word Shisandra, S-C-H-I-S-A-N-D-R-A, and it's also known as the Chinese five spice berry.
Okay.
So you get salty, sour, bitter, and sweet.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, we do krauts with it. It's not local, no, it's of the, you know, Southeast Asian varietal, but we do get it organically grown. And yeah, it's a wonderful little berry. It's also an adaptogen herb, so it's an herb that works with reducing stress and anxiety levels in your body. It's great. It's good stuff.
It's real good.
Yeah.
So you do non-waste. What do you do with all your SCOBYs? You're one of the larger batch companies I've seen that uses actual SCOBYs still.
Real what?
Yeah, a lot of them will. Yeah, a lot of them will. We've had a couple of people on who are like, "Oh, we just use like the inoculate, and then that just kind of works."
You mean the starter liquid?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can do that. I mean,
well, like, what do you do with the extras?
We sell them.
Sell them.
We never throw them away unless they're old, and you can tell when a SCOBY is past its prime.
Yeah, we sell them. We put them in little kits and we sell them to people. We also do a SCOBY giveaway every once in a while. We'll just sort of like we have a lot of customers that will return our glass jars. And so we reuse those glass jars. And then when we get a lot of them and we have a lot of SCOBY, we just announce on Twitter or Instagram and be like, this Saturday, free SCOBY day at Hex Ferments, and you can come and get a free SCOBY.
I should start doing that.
Yeah, and so that brings people that may have never come to the shop before. They can come and taste the kombucha. If they are wanting to, they can go home and make it themselves.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys, with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, Eat 'em to Save 'em, was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
Can we talk a little bit about that bright purple kombucha that you have?
I'm all sure right. Well, what intrigues you about it? Just because it's bright purple?
Yeah. Also, I don't know what butterfly flavor is.
Okay. Do you want to?
Yeah. Because generally a lot of kombuchas will have, or commercial kombuchas will have, like, fruit flavors or, like, ginger or turmeric or something
like that.
Or cayenne. But, like, this is, like, the first beautiful looking kombucha I've seen in a while.
Well, I mean, we want things to look good. We're artists. So things have to look good.
Hence your awesome logo.
Oh, what's that?
Yeah, your logo is beautiful.
Oh, thank you. So
all of them, they've got to look good in the bottle.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, we've had this sort of unique experience where we didn't just start wholesaling. We had to sell to the public right away. So from that, we got to educate the customer about what fermentation is and what it does for health benefits. But also, we were dealing a lot with people who had tried things and had tried really poorly made things. And so they had this idea that kombucha was supposed to taste bad, or that it could hurt them, or that, I don't know, a myriad of things that people thought what fermented foods are. And so we had to really dispel the fear of some of those improperly informed.
Not dissimilar from people who have had a factory tomato versus a, you know, heirloom local tomato, and how much variance there is, how much narrative, you know, just imbued in that one tomato. And similarly for, you know, a taste of sauerkraut or kombucha, everybody has a lot of...
Is this all naturally carbonated?
Yes.
It's incredible. It's very, very carbonated.
Yep.
Well, it's a lot less carbonated than forced carbonated.
Yeah.
Softer bubble, a little easier on the palate.
It's actually better for your esophagus and stomach, too.
Alkalizing.
Yeah.
Bubble.
So the butterfly lime is made with a pea flower, which is the flower of the pea plant. But it's a particular variety that gets pretty large. It's about that big, about an inch and a half.
It's like a half dollar size.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's dried, and they're like an indigo color, which is purple in vegetables and nature is naturally occurring. It's created by an anthocyanin, which is an antioxidant enzyme, and it has a bright purple hue. When it's brewed, it's indigo, and then as it acidifies, it turns purple. So it's a popular drink in Thailand, and in Thailand they serve it cold, and then they serve it with a wedge of lime, and then they squeeze the wedge of lime over the glass, and you can see it change before your eyes. The kombucha acidification does that naturally.
And then to honor that beverage, we add organic lime juice and then a touch of raw local honey.
Oh, nice.
So that's the basis, the base for this particular kombucha. And it's caffeine-free. And a lot of people also don't realize that kombucha is done with black or green teas. And believe it or not, there's a lot of people in the world that don't want to drink caffeine.
Yeah.
But they, you can still get the lift that kombucha gives you without that extra, like, kick of caffeine as well. So this is a very popular one, especially with moms that are trying to wean their kids off soda. This has been, like, a popular alternative to that. So go ahead. You should give it a try.
Yeah,
it's so pretty.
Thank you.
It smells incredible.
Oh, wow. So we just started working with a farm.
Oh, wow. I would drink that a lot.
That we're hoping can grow enough for us locally so we don't have to source it from afar.
Oh, the pea flower?
Yeah.
Now, on your Hex Ferments website, you recommend drinking kombucha on an empty stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason for that?
You know, yes, there is. You want to drink something that is new to you, especially with such a powerful probiotic benefit, in small amounts, just to kind of warm your body up to the idea of something like that's alive. So we always suggest to newcomers to start drinking just a little bit in the morning, preferably after you've had some water in your system, before you've had coffee or tea, and just let it alkalize you and just let it kind of even out your pH, let it kind of wake up your stomach. It's extremely helpful for people that suffer from chronic constipation, which is a lot of America. We field a lot of questions about constipation and diarrhea. It's a daily conversation here.
And all that said, we are not doctors, but we do have a deep interest in food as medicine and pay attention to ours and the community's health. So, our disclaimer.
Yeah, our disclaimer. But mostly they just taste really good.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing to talk to customers that have been drinking it for a few months and them exclaiming how much it's helped them. And that right there is like, we've hit a home run. Like, not only are they enjoying the flavor of it and it's helped them accomplish other flavor exploration, perhaps into some of the sauerkrauts or just even live cultured foods like tempeh and maybe some different beers and meads, and that it's really helped them.
So you would recommend for someone just starting to eat fermentations, they should start with kombucha, or would you recommend something else?
It depends.
Either way, whatever your entry into sour may be, roll with it. And there's I do a lot of farmers markets as well, and drawing parallels, again, trying to dispel food fears, preconceived notions about what something should taste like. Sometimes we'll have to change our language and the way that we present it depending on some of those cues that we receive in the interaction. But, you know, it's food. It's you know, nutrient-dense vegetables that people should be eating more of. Our biology is entwined with this type of eating. We're of the mind that a lot of how we got here with industrial food is undermining a lot of the health of, you know, people, communities, planet, and we're doing our part in small transcendent ways to add live foods and flavor into the community.
But when people come to the counter, we taste everything, and we encourage people to taste, because a lot of times somebody might come here and be like, oh, my naturopath told me to come and eat fermented foods, but I've never had it before. So we just start talking about what we have available. We have three menus, so it takes a little bit of time. But then we kind of go down, and then they pick out usually maybe five or six things that pique their interest, and we do a little tasting. And from there, they can decide, you know, like, I'm going to put this in my body. And sometimes people really gravitate. They'll come here and they'll say, oh, I want to drink kombucha. But then we get talking and they try it and they don't like it. And they decide to go with just plain sauerkraut instead. Or they're weaning themselves off of sugar. There's a lot of people that come for that. And they'll actually go for the kombucha first. And then we'll notice as they return back their bottles over time, then they'll start reaching out to some more of the sauerkrauts.
So let's take a break to try some stuff. Yeah. What have we got here? So This is the miso kimchi?
Yeah, that's the miso kimchi. This is our glow kraut. It was actually a good food 2017 finalist. So that's with turmeric, black pepper, black seed or nigella seeds, and a little ginger, garlic, and onion. And then this is one of our personal faves. It's our black Spanish radish with some sweet peppers. Very simple, straightforward ferment with some really potent flavors. And then this is our spring fire kimchi. We do what I call seasonal fire kimchis. So this is our one from spring. And we work with a farm here called Moon Valley. And they grow a lot of daikon for their soil. It's like a cover crop for them. So this is what they had available in March when we were planning our spring fire. So this is daikons with local red Korean pepper, local lemon drop pepper, kombucha ginger powder, and fermented garlic powder.
So there's ferments in the spices as well.
Yes, yes, yes. And that doesn't really add, I mean, as far as I know, I don't think it adds anything but... Not right, you know, maybe it's something a little bit microbially, but just flavor. So that's what we're going to try here.
All right. You can put down the mic. Try some stuff.
And,
oh my goodness. I'm so excited about this. I'm so kidding.
We have a little.
Nope, I lied. Oh, that's fine. Just couch shooter. Oh my goodness.
This is the miso one?
This is the miso kimchi. This is really, really good.
Thank you.
It's like good food or something.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
There's two different cultures, though, for the miso and for the kimchi, or is it...
I mean, quite literally and figuratively, you know, Japanese-style miso.
So koji, that's separate. The start of the...
Okay.
It's not good, usually with a grain or a rice.
Got it. Yeah. But there's no sort of like interaction though when you put the two together. That
I'm sure there is.
Any trouble?
No trouble we found.
Okay.
It's our our most active ferment and our shortest ferment. So this is from start to finish, you know, it takes about 3-4 days to actually make it and then 5 days to ferment.
Wow.
And then at 5 days, we roll it into the walk-in. And then let it kind of chill for a couple days, let it settle, and then we put it in jars. Yep. So quick turnaround.
And this is the glow.
That's
kraut.
The glow kraut.
So I see a lot of turmeric in this.
A lot of turmeric. Yeah, it's the blend of spices themselves are an Ayurvedic blend that helps with inflammation. Also known to help detoxify skin, so helping your skin.
I'm a really big fan of turmeric. This is really good.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we wanted it to be enough turmeric, but not enough turmeric to, like, send you running for the hills. Because if you overdo turmeric...
it tastes a little weird. There's a weird powdery texture to it. Yeah.
A little off the charts.
This is really good, though. While we're trying these, can you talk about... So you do a lot of seasonal ferments. You have, like, kind of your standard ferments.
Yep.
And then you also have your seasonal ones. So do you have anything interesting coming up for the summer? You mentioned pickles on sticks.
Oh, yeah. We're in a weird spot right now. Usually we have, this is filled and it's filled with 8 or 10 varieties. So this is our small batch right now.
Still a giant list.
Yeah. So we're sold out of a few things.
Oh,
yeah.
Sandor kraut. Is that his style sauerkraut? Or I just named it after him.
we did. So the Sandor kraut was a white kimchi that got forgotten about. And true to Sandor Katz, you know, he has such a great the way that he teaches is something that we aspire to. You know, fermentation, yeah. You know, there's no rules. There's rules, but there's no rules at the same time.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we kind of forgot about this during a very busy time, and that it was fine and that it tasted amazing was just, in a way, it harkened back to those very first days when we're kind of refining our practice and, you know, not be afraid to take risks and try things. So this is a double ferment. It's real sour.
And Sander is very capable of very sour tolerances.
Too. Yes, yes.
We were digging in some of the old, like, Jack Daniel's barrels he had around at his place.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's like, I think this is from this year. Or maybe it's from last year anyway. And he's like, well, let's dig in, you know. And, you know, at the time, this is probably, what, 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, despite having a foreknowledge of, you know, the lack of foodborne illness from fermented vegetables, you know, it took some courage to dig into the bottom of this barrel that had maybe some, you know, like bugs on, like insects on the top and stuff, and, you know, scraped away some mold, dug in there, and it was beautiful and delicious, and we are all the better for it. Yeah.
So this is a double ferment.
This is really good.
Yeah, this is like something you eat with, like, you know, greasy ribs. It's cut the fat kind of kraut. So we did a double ferment of garlic scapes in a 5% brine. And then did the white kimchi separately, and then we added the two together and let that ferment.
Wow.
It went through many different stages of very potent smell.
So this was a kimchi before it had the spices added, or they just kind of...
Well, originally kimchi never had red pepper.
Okay.
So this has everything but red pepper. So it still has ginger, onions, garlic, double garlic, actually, and the Napa cabbage.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the standard kraut.
It definitely doesn't taste like your usual kind of kimchi or sauerkraut. Like,
no. It's to me, it just tastes like a big pickle.
Kraut cheese.
Yeah. When we had Cedric Cass on the show, and he was talking about how every time he goes to a function, someone will make him some sort of dark leaf kraut just to prove that it can be done. And he gave us this really, really old kale sauerkraut, and it was really good, but also, like, you could not eat more than, like, a spoonful at a time.
Yeah, brassicas in that dark leafy, cruciferous vegetables like that over an amount of time can get very strong.
Yeah.
Very strong. So, yeah, things we're excited about for summer. We have a power kraut. With Shizandra berries, nettles, kale, green cabbage, and some jalapeno powder.
Nettles?
Yep. Nettles are one of our favorite foraged things to work with in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have our summer fire kimchi, which we're also calling velvet kimchi, which is made with black garlic.
Okay.
And pickles, of course. Moon Valley grows us our pickles. Wouldn't that be cool? Pickles grow on trees. They grow a particular variety of cucumber for us.
Okay.
So we'll have those on a stick. And when we get the really big guys, we don't put those in jars. We just spear them, and then we have a pickle jar in here. Pickle on a stick for a buck.
Nice.
Yeah, and that's a very popular summer treat for a lot of people.
And you guys just did a bunch of ramp pickles, is that right?
It's gone.
Yeah.
So we work with these chefs that also are sustainable practicing foragers, and they have a couple of secret plots out in West Virginia that they have been, that they've been propagating and carefully working with those little plots to maintain their health so that they're constantly reproducing so they're not over-foraging. So this is the second year that we were able to get ramps from them. And we do a very, very, very small amount. They take forever to clean. And then we just keep it true to the ramp, and we dry grind them very lightly and add in some local red pepper. And that's it.
Wow.
And we keep them whole. And they sell out within a week.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing.
So just a, I think, one or two final questions. So how have you guys seen the kind of Baltimore fermentation scene transform ever since you started this, how many years ago? Like 4 or 5 years ago?
We've been here 3, but we've been actively fermenting here for...
outwardly fermenting for 4. Like, first farmer's market was like 4 or 5? Was it? Yeah.
4 years
it's funny, we just had an event
Thursday. That's right, you guys had a class, right? That you were teaching?
It was like a panel discussion with other food preservationists. But it was at Artifact in town where we had originally participated in a farmer's market behind Artifact. And a lot of those same relationships that we made there, including original customers, are still with us today. Our neighbor here, Gingy Chocolate, she does a raw, beautiful raw chocolate right next door. Farmers, all kinds of relationships started there. And yeah, the also Heritage Radio Network recording was called Origins. And so our joke then was trying to kind of remember our origin story, because amazingly, just with all of this forward momentum, we've kind of failed to look back in a way that we need to. So spend a lot of time remembering the early days and, you know, each stage of growth and
As fermentation goes, though, it was sort of like, I think as we became here, we had, I would say, a good 6 months of kind of just people coming out of the woodwork, like sharing their stories about either their grandparents fermenting or Baltimore stories about going down to the corner deli and being able to reach into a barrel and grab a whole pickled onion. Like, so that culture was starting to come out, which was really cool.
Whenever we'd hear something like that, we'd try to ferment it and do it. Yeah, nice.
And so that just created a lot of conversation just right here. And then when we started doing more farmers markets, you know, people would give us what they made. And that was always really like, wow, what an honor. Like, you're sharing your pickles with me and then you're buying my stuff. Like, whoa, that's pretty wild. But then too, like, you know, we've seen more chefs get into it. More pickle things, more pickles, more people eating produce is always a good thing.
Yeah, a general awareness, I think. And Baltimore is very culinary curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of food exploration
here.
The
stranger, the things we had on our menu, the like more
curious
yeah. people got.
Sure.
So the black Spanish is one of those. So people were like, "What is a black radish?" So this ferment. Also Sander inspired, is, so a black radish is the first cultivar of radish. So before we had bright purples and bright reds and your little cherry bells and your French breakfast radishes, your Easter egg radishes, we had a black Spanish radish. And then from that became all these different varieties of radishes.
Apparently the black radish helped, was the main fuel to build the pyramids.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very humble vegetable in its beginnings. It's a very pungent vegetable.
Yeah, there isn't much like flavoring in this aside from there's just sea salt and peppercorn, and it's just such a good flavor too.
Thank you.
Naturally.
Yeah, it's earthy. It's dark. It goes great with like a really like nice hard cheese.
Oh,
it's nice hard salami.
Earthy. That's just really shines through and is fantastic.
Oh yeah,
you know, like all of these. Typically, they're not eaten alone, but combined with other foods. That one in particular has this just incredible synergistic effect with foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a favorite there.
Sure. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
If our listeners want to check out Hex Ferments, are you guys having any events coming up in Baltimore? Or in
every day it's an event here. Yeah. You can always come by. You can taste everything that we offer in the case.
Yeah, everybody which, that works here makes everything, so they're very knowledgeable in almost all the things that we do. We just did the event the other night at Artifact, which was a lot of fun for Origins. What do we got coming up? We do a farmer's market every day here in Baltimore City, Waverly Farmer's Market.
Every
Saturday.
Yeah.
The big farmer's market downtown, the Baltimore Farmer's Market. Right now we kind of lay low on events just because we're busy doing all that. But we do partner often with Roots Market in Clarksville, where we offer workshops, and people can find out about that on our website or Facebook or Instagram.
All right, pop your website. What is it? Hexferments.com?
Hexferments.com.
And where can we find you on social media?
At Hexferments.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Rachel. This was fun. Thanks, Saul. You guys had a good time.
This is for Men About It.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Waley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.